Hello there. He's Ralph. I'm Peter. Let's do this. In this week's edition of The Chat, we'll be talking about three things. Firstly, OpenAI and the departure of Sam Altman. Secondly, we'll be doing talking about Hotel Chocolat going to Mars. And thirdly, we'll be talking about the future balance of the West End, City and Canary Wharf, basically because Land Securities, which is one of the country's biggest property developers, is moving towards the West End. So in the first instance, let's talk about OpenAI. So on Friday night, Sam Altman, one of the co-founders of OpenAI, which is obviously at the cutting edge of AI, he left the company along with another of the three co-founders, leaving the final one surviving co-founder, who is the chief scientist in the setup. The board basically removed Sam Altman and the other guy, and they only knew, or certainly Sam Altman only knew, 30 minutes before we all did. So it's an absolute shocker. Sam Altman arguably is the face not just of OpenAI, but AI in general. And to have something like this happen is quite incredible. I'm trying to think if I've seen anything quite like this in my career. Not really. And the suddenness of it all suggests, I would say, that there is something very, very, very seriously wrong going on. Now, this was obviously released on Friday night. Maybe this was, you know, planned, because if it had been released during the week, the following day would have been an absolute disaster, I would have thought, in terms of sentiment. There would have been all sorts of stuff done. Whereas, obviously, releasing something on a Friday night may have been, you know, or late on Friday, there may be reason behind that, to let people get used to it over the weekend, maybe feed out some news or something over the weekend, and then restart on Monday. But anyway, my point is, this is a very rare event. This is a very serious event. And I think that we are going to need to see a lot more in the way of discussion on this and reasons behind it. You know, I imagine that Microsoft will be mildly panicking at the moment. But what do you think, Ralph?
I don't think anything.
Brilliant. Thanks very much. Anyway, so the second thing we're going to know. Anyway.
Exactly. This is going to be a very quick one, a very quick podcast. Sacking somebody, if indeed that is what has occurred on a Friday afternoon, does mean that there is going to be the rumor mill cranking up during the weekend. And unfortunately, this is kind of all I have to offer on this. I mean, I certainly don't look behind the scenes. Very few people do. And before we know what's going on, we are, of course, not any the wiser. And yet, everybody is on Twitter talking about this, and people are speculating what might be behind it. So I can't do anything anything like that, and I can certainly not offer to shed any light on this. But therefore, all I would like to say is may make some general points. In my career as an equity analyst, of course, ever so often similar things tended to happen. Maybe a CFO retired early, or a person, a CEO, had to go. A CFO of a big group resurfaced as a CEO of a smaller company within the group. And whenever this happened, there was a short press release leaving the analysts to wonder what might be behind this. So we were all in this very same position. And what I can say is that what may have been behind it, or what the company then officially announced, perhaps several days later, in response to an increase in the traffic of chatter, never really tended to chime with the conspiracy theories which had been expounded. So I wouldn't necessarily trust anything that I read about this now. What I would say is, well, another anecdote. I mean, this sometimes happens when people get sacked on a Friday night, if indeed that's what it was. I mean, I don't know whether you guys remember, this happened some 15 years ago, where some senior person in the city, in some company in the city, which I forgot what it was, was sacked, and they left the office, then discovered that they had forgotten their something in the office, their card or something, wanted to get back in. The card didn't work, and the porter informed them that their card had been revoked. And the Daily Mail said, managing director in this business sacked by the porter, which, of course, didn't used to happen. And it's just another thing of how the rumor mill sometimes cranks up here. What I would say is that Sam Altman was quite vociferous, perhaps was certainly a known voice in the discussion which is currently focusing on regulation within AI. Should there be regulation, and if so, what form ought regulation to take? And ChatGPT is the sort of business which burst on the scene as the company which put remarkable technology into the hands of retail people like me who know nothing about this. So to some extent, ChatGPT, OpenAI, is in the firing line, with is in the forefront of those businesses who will need to talk about regulation. So again, I'm not going to necessarily speculate, but I believe that there was certainly something happening between Seth Altman's stance on regulation and perhaps some mainstream view within the company, perhaps encouraged by its majority owners, Microsoft, which perhaps stood against what Sam Altman was formulating as his stance on regulation. But now I am doing what I was saying I was not going to do. I'm speculating. So it's just my own response to this is testimony to how easy it is to slip into the speculation. It is hardly avoidable. What I would say is that, yes, there must be something very significant behind this. And we will have to watch this space and see if indeed it is of a significance that might shake up the tech world and the AI world.
Brilliant. I am going to go into conspiracy theory mode.
No, fair enough.
And I'm going to say, I totally agree with what you say. I'm just thinking, number one, this has got to be mega serious. I mean, even like we've seen recently with BP, we've seen the chief executive left because he had been having relationships with his underlings and hadn't hadn't revealed all to the management about it. They found out, then that's what they had to do. But even then, that seems to take a bit of time. This is incredibly sudden, and the only time I've ever seen anything like this is if something really bad is going to come out. So that's interesting. If it's really bad and it's a personal thing, like, let's say, I don't know, bro culture or something like that. I don't know. There's, and maybe harassment or something like that. That's obviously serious. But in terms of for OpenAI, actually, that's a personal thing, for Sam. And okay, yes, it is a cultural thing as well, but it's a personal thing, and you can cut that out, remove it, and it will still keep going. The problem is if it is some kind of fundamental problem with OpenAI, like Have they overstated figures, for instance? Have they overstated, you know, this, or have they found some kind of bug or something like that? But you know, even then, to actually remove two co-founders with no warning is extremely rare. So anyway, we'll see what happens. I think that, and you know, the other thing, of course, is what again might happen, maybe, but this is more further down the line. Is so there's a few things. So one is that the two co-founders may go off and found another AI, right? They might do that, and of course, they will be able to raise a lot of money really quickly because they're well known. Or it could be, this could be an amazing opportunity for Microsoft to just buy OpenAI, because they, you know, they presumably everyone's going to be spooked by it. And so, you know, the valuation of OpenAI won't be as full as perhaps it would have been with the, with all of the co-founders intact. And if that were the case, then that may, you know, you would have thought that that's going to make life a bit difficult for Google and Meta and, you know, anyone else who has AI ambitions, because they might suddenly be panicking that Microsoft is suddenly going to get a lot more powerful. But that's
indeed. Actually, that's what my mind would go towards. It's more like professional or philosophical differences, perhaps, if the two co-founders disappear. Indeed, they might reappear in a different business which they are founding. In fact, that's, I think, what Sam tweeted on X. Can you actually still say tweeted? No, that it's not.
Yeah, no, I think Twitter it is anymore. Still tweeted. Yeah,
or
I think
you have
it
to say X.
I don't know. I think it doesn't sound the same, does it? I think it is tweeted, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, what he tweeted on X is that he said something like, watch this space for future professional developments or something. It's almost like hinting at the fact that he will pop up somewhere else, as we all think he will surely do. And so that's kind of more what I'm thinking. And professional differences, maybe philosophical differences as to where he would have wanted to take GPT next, and where perhaps Microsoft, as influential owners, are preferring it to end up. So that's what I would think or expect. And if that was the case, then it's going to be very interesting to see where indeed they are going to end up, what indeed they are going to found next, and what philosophy that business will espouse. Because clearly we've talked about this a lot in the context of regulation of AI, LLMs, the sort of businesses which put quite a lot of power at the hands of individuals who may be lay people, who indeed are typically lay people, and perhaps the next business which they are founding, if that is to be the case, is going to have a different philosophy. And that, if it were to happen, is, I think, going to be interesting and telling about where the AI world in general is going to go next, where what the trends are going to be, given the central importance and originality of these guys who just left.
I mean, I think also it's going to take the shine off AI for the moment. I mean, it's been an absolute frenzy. You know, Nvidia, for instance, has been doing incredibly well from this. You know, maybe this will take the shine off because it will inject a bit of uncertainty into the proceedings. Very interesting. Well, you know, watch this space. It's going to get interesting. So anyway, so there you go. So that's a bit of a conspiracy theory for you for a podcast. I mean, conspiracy theories, chat about, you know, inflation and stuff. I mean, that's what we're all here for, right? So, we were going to talk about inflation today, but don't worry, we're not going to, because I said we just need to stop talking about inflation for a bit, even though actually it's slowing down. But anyway.
You said it. I was gonna squeeze that in at some point. Oh, you stole my thunder.
Sorry. Anyway, so let's go on to the next thing, which is about chocolate. So, Hotel Chocolat goes to Mars. Is, I think, a headline that really that I didn't see, and it's an absolute gift of a headline, but anyway, I'm going to claim it, and say that that, you know, so Mars, the massive corporation of Mars Bar and other confectionery fame and pet food fame, for that matter, is actually basically bought Hotel Chocolat, so posh British chocolate shop thing, for about half a billion quid, a lot. When you consider this is a 169.8% premium to its share price on Wednesday, which is very big. So from, you know, overall, you would have thought that Mars gets out of this a sort of high-end boutique-y kind of chocolate brand. And on the other hand, Hotel Chocolat gets access to a sugar daddy, quite literally in this case.
A sugar daddy
that has very deep pockets, and has great supply chains all around the world. You know, Hotel Chocolat had to give up expansion plans in the US and in Japan most recently. And, you know, maybe with the help and deep pockets of Mars behind them, maybe they can try again. I don't know about in those markets, but certainly elsewhere, having learnt what they've learnt, but have the backing of a major, you know, of a major corporation. Something like the founders, the two founders are going to make something like 280 million pounds between them. So, you know, they can buy a few Mars bars with that. So I mean, I think that's you know, and actually one of them, Angus Thirlwell, and he's going to stay on as chief exec, etc. I think it's a really interesting story. I'd say it's particularly good for Hotel Chocolat, and particularly good if you are one of the two sharing in the 280 million quid. But I think it's less good, but still good for Mars because it gets another brand. But what do you think?
Well, it must be good for Mars because otherwise they wouldn't have done it, obviously. You know, this podcast is brilliant. Either I'm going to talk about things I know nothing about, which I have just said, and actually have probably said for the last 20 years in my as a stockbroker, or I'm going to just trade platitudes. So this is what I'm going to do today.
Fantastic. Nice.
So it has to be good for Mars. Mars, I think, is a very well-run business. And they haven't really taken a wrong step very often in their history as a business. So I would be highly surprised if they had not paid this very hefty premium for a reason. Yes, the purchasing price, I don't think, means much in the context of Mars, but it's still a business which does not just simply go about and buy chocolate here and there without any clear and strategically thought through business rationale. So the first thing I want to say is what I always say when we talk about M&A, that it's very difficult for somebody to understand who sits outside the business without looking at the numbers. I mean, if I look at something like 170% premium, that means they pay 2.7 times the existing share price. If you want to translate this into sort of growth, they have to basically grow the valuation specific driver maybe that's earnings, by something like 10% every year for the next 10 years before they actually even break even on this. And you're not going to want to break even within 10 years. You want the payback period of any kind of investment to be maybe 2, maybe 3 years at most. And so for them to really develop this business into something which will pay back, well, more than pay back the premium they just paid, they would need to develop it into a massive growth business. And this is, of course, exactly what Hotel Chocolat wasn't able to do. Growth does not necessarily mean just growing the sales of your existing product in your existing market. It is, as you said, expanding territorially. And they try to expand to the US and to Japan, but the taste of their product wasn't to taste, literally, of people in these markets. And so one wonders, if you look at their pronouncement, they said they're not going to change the recipes of Hotel Chocolat. The CEO stays on to manage the business. So by all accounts, this is an amicable purchase. Although the premium might actually suggest somebody actually forced them to pay a lot for this, but that's just a facetious comment. So it's an amicable purchase. Clearly, Hotel Chocolat is there to stay and develop its business in its current form within the confines of a much bigger balance sheet. So that's the reality for Hotel Chocolat. But precisely because they are going to stay the same business, because Mars is going to retain the brand as the brand, because they're going to retain key personnel, it is not going to be obvious to me, at least, where the synergies are going to be. Mars is selling products such as Mars bars, Snickers, I think.
Do they? I'm still looking.
M&M's.
Because they own Wrigley's. They own Wrigley's as well.
M&M's, Twix, Maltesers, Milky Way. What else can I think? Oh, something called Starburst, I think.
Yeah, Skittles, M&M's, Mars
Bars, Original, and all this kind of stuff. That's basically the product range which we know from Mars. Bounty as well. So that's the sort of thing. It's basically, if you go into a supermarket and you don't know what to do when you're at the cash out, I mean, that's the sort of stuff which you load up into your basket. And so these things are actually quite tasty. But they're not necessarily something which you would associate with the top end of the chocolate market. And I don't necessarily know this myself, but my wife is a chocoholic. So I speak with some sort of insight here when I say that first of all, the bars, the bar market is a different market anyway, isn't it? The Snickers and Bounty, these are not pure chocolates. Whereas Hotel Chocolat, these are pure chocolate makers. When you go to Hotel Chocolat, you get something like slabs, little slabs of chocolate, which are salted caramel, dark chocolate, these kind of things. So they may not be pure chocolate, but the taste is very unique. And that's what you get. You don't get coconut enveloped in chocolate, which is a completely different taste. And so my wife informs me that the best chocolates in the world are Swiss, and apparently they are Sprüngli and Lederach. You guys just have to believe that now, you know, because I certainly can't tell you whether it's true or not, but I can tell you that these two chocolates are really very nice.
And the Hotel Chocolat comes in at third place, does it?
It's the first place in the UK.
So it's a podium position, which is pretty good, right? Bronze medal.
It's bronze medal. Exactly. Actually, anybody who wishes to get some Lederach, there's a business here in London where you can buy some Lederach, and it's absolutely fantastic. They're sold in these huge slabs. You may have seen these. They are sort of probably 1 meter times 70 centimeter slabs, and they break off from the slabs, and they are really, really good.
Oh, I've never done that. Okay.
It's in Regent Street, close to Oxford Circus.
Oh, right. Didn't know that. No, didn't know that. It's a bit like when you go to, W.H. Smith at the station, and they say, do you want what? You could buy this big bar of dairy milk for £1 or something like that. Mm-hmm. But more upmarket version, right?
Yeah, it's nothing like that.
Nice. Yeah,
and it also sets you back quite a lot of money. I mean, I don't know exactly what it costs, but the price is noticeable. So anyway, so what am I saying here? Right, so basically, Haute Chocolat plays in that sort of market. It is high-end gourmet chocolate. Mm-hmm. And you can only think that perhaps with the balance sheet of Mars, it will be able to develop a high-end chocolate product which will be to the taste of consumers in America and in Japan. That, I think, must be what is behind the idea from Haute Chocolat's point of view, but it must also clearly be the idea of Mars, because the volume, the sales volume which Mars can expect from Haute Chocolat may not make a dent into their corporate balance, corporate P&L. But of course, we're talking about this here in the context of what they paid for the business. Mm. And so I'm thinking that must be where the hidden rationale of this is. Haute Chocolat, clearly a business which is trying to capitalize on its brand in the UK and developing markets outside of the UK, failing to be able to do this with more investment, with a bigger balance sheet, which is not only going to be able to provide the funds for R&D, but it's also going to be big enough to actually consume and absorb any failures in the R&D product development. Now, that might actually turn into a success story.
Mm. Yes, we shall see, won't we? But I think it'll be, this is, I was genuinely surprised by this. And I think that this could do amazing things. I mean, I did mention this on the podcast the other day, how in my experience, the tastes of consumers do differ between countries. And you know, I always found that if you were on the sweetness scale, America is at one end and Japan is at the other, and the UK is somewhere in the middle. So in America, they like very, very, very sweet stuff. So, you know, I'm, by the way, I'm the sort of person who I'm not fussed about, you know, Coke versus Pepsi and stuff. You know, I kind of lump it all in the same thing. So I'm not funny like that, but I remember that those soft drinks are noticeably sweeter in America than they are in the UK, and the ones in Japan are notably less sweet. And mm-hmm. So maybe because we're kind of in the middle, maybe that's why we didn't quite satisfy the American market, and that's why we didn't satisfy the Japanese market. Maybe, I don't know, but anyway, we'll see what happens with a massive company behind it. You would have thought that the prospects for Haute Chocolat should be pretty good, so we'll see. So on to the third and final thing. I'm going to be talking about the future balance of the West End City and Canary Wharf. Now, the reason why we're talking about this is because we saw some results from some of the big real estate companies this week. One of them called Land Securities, or often abbreviated to LandSec, which means, or LandSec. Now, that sounds a bit naughty, so that's why I'm saying Land Securities. That's why I'm saying Land Securities is one of the, sorry, So so one of the country's biggest property developers. Now, apparently their portfolio, it's a commercial property portfolio, has shifted away from the City of London over much more over to the West End. Now, a lot of people may be looking at that and thinking, wow, that means then that that's the death of the city. Everyone's going to the West End. You know, there's talk that the trend is that companies are asking for smaller space because of the working from home hybrid working thing, and that they want to maybe give their employees a bit more incentive to come in by having their offices located in more buzzy sort of areas like the West End. That's the argument. I would, you know, for what it's worth, I would say that I remember, and this is a very long time ago now, that when the when Canary Wharf was really starting to kick off, everyone thought, oh, well, that's it then. You know, everyone's going to leave. They're going to go to Canary Wharf in a shiny new building and leave all the history of the city behind. It's happened a bit, but not completely. And actually, the city continues to thrive. And so, you know, I kind of wonder whether everyone's predicting the death of Canary Wharf and the city, but actually I don't think so. But anyway, what do you think, Ralph?
Yeah, I don't think so either. It's all very difficult for me to understand, because I think the pandemic has thrown a spanner in the works, so to speak, in terms of social trends of how we wish to work. I mean, if anybody still remembers the years before the pandemic, there was already a trend towards flexible working. There was a trend towards I think 15 years ago we called these people with a strange phrase, which isn't used anymore. They're called road warriors. These are people who are basically having laptops and having all sorts of electronic equipment, and they basically were able to work from the road, from anywhere. And that was the done thing. Everybody wanted to be up on this and cutting edge technology. But that hasn't really happened. What has happened was that people were wanting to work partly from home and partly from the office. And this is something, this is a trend which started to exert itself before the pandemic. And then with the pandemic, it wasn't a trend anymore, it was a necessity. So everybody had to work from home because there was no way to work from the office because the office was shut. So now we are in the sort of aftermath of this, and I don't think that social trends have properly have sort of bedded down yet. We don't really quite know where we are going to go with this. What is obvious is there is a trend towards hybrid working, and that trend is, I think, here to stay. As a consequence, some of the large companies of this world, and I'm going to pick one out as an example, HSBC, has taken the decision to reduce its office space by a remarkable number. I think HSBC wants to reduce its office space by 40% globally. Other companies have not followed on. JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs are famous for forcing people back into the office 5 days a week. I think they have people with whips as well, chaining them to their desks.
So different, wasn't it, in lockdown, where they were trying to tempt people back by free ice cream and stuff like that. That came to an end.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But at HSBC, you're not going to be chained to your desk. Quite the opposite. You are given the opportunity to work from home, but it is going to be something, I think, like a 40-60 split or 30-70 split. I mean, you can work from home, that's cool, but you have to be in the office as well. Anyway, the result of it is that a lot of companies are downsizing their office space, and they're now looking for office space which is still modern enough to support their businesses, but just simply not as much of it. Now, HSBC, interestingly, has not gone to the West End. HSBC has gone to St. Paul's, which is sort of just the outskirts of the city, where a new building has been built, which does offer them the technology and the developed office space that they need with, you know, whatever it is these days, Cat7 cables, one would assume, Wi-Fi, etc., and all the other amenities which one needs, also open space, working with other social amenities such as open buffets and things like this, and all this kind of stuff is happening a lot more in office spaces now. As an anecdote, this also was something that at some point was very fashionable indeed, sort of alternative office space and behavior. There was one business which I used to remember, and I'm not going to mention it. It's defunct now. Unfortunately, they have disappeared. But I rocked up for a meeting there, and everybody was hopping about on these. Do you remember these space ball things? Yeah, exactly. I mean, the people were actually hopping about on these on these space balloons in the office. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are bankrupt now. I wonder why. Anyway, yeah. What I meant to illustrate with this is just simply that there are modern, more inclusive ways of working and socializing, both at work in the office space and also at home, of course, where the hybrid working model comes in.
Hmm.
So what I have illustrated now is HSBC going from Canary Wharf to St. Paul's in an effort to downsize. But it's just downsizing. It is not downsizing in quality. It's just downsizing in physical space, how much office you need. Now, moving into the West End, now that's a different kind of operation altogether, because the West End is, well, in terms of stock of office space, it's just not as developed as the City of London and Canary Wharf and the Docklands. I'm just reading out something to you, which is from the Guide to Office Space in London's West End, which describes the quality of the office space there. And it says here, quote, "Many of the offices in the West End are in beautiful historic period buildings, Victorian, Edwardian, and Georgian, which have been elegantly restored and refurbished to provide high quality workspace," unquote. Now, we've both been working for investment banks all our lives. Can you imagine the head trader of a business shouting at you across a beautifully restored Georgian building? Perhaps, but that's not where investment banks are. That's not where stockbrokers are. If I'm a stockbroker, I wish to sit on a dealing floor, and I wish to have the buzz and the social interaction which comes with my profession. I don't necessarily want the buzz which comes when I leave the office. Say my office is at Tottenham Court Road and I leave the office there. Yes, it's a buzz, but it's a completely different buzz than the one which you have in the City of London, where you stay between the profession. You have stockbrokers, lawyers, investment bankers, etc. In Tottenham Court Road, you might have all sorts of people, tourists included. And so what I think is, I'm not trusting this trend to be sustainable. I think that's what I'm sort of the conclusion I'm working towards. When I actually see Landsec, and please note how I pronounce this, when I see Landsec saying that 75%, I think, of the portfolio is now in the West End, which used to be 60% or so. I'm wondering whether that is a trend that is currently exerting itself, but a trend which is not going to be sustainable. Because businesses such as HSBC, big law firms, they would still want their businesses, their space, their office space, to be together. They don't want it to be disjointed in different small offices here and there. And as businesses will grow again after the pandemic, after the various geopolitical instability will eventually have quieted down, after inflation will have come down, which it has actually currently, just saying that.
Nice.
See?
Nice.
I got it.
Yeah.
After all of this, businesses will grow, and then they will need to perhaps go the other way again. They will reassert that they will need bigger office space again. Office space in the Docklands will be available also at a lower price, in the City of London at a lower price. So I don't believe that this is going to be the end of the Docklands or the City of London. I believe it's marking a current but temporary trend towards a different form of working, characterized but not dominated by the hybrid model, which will change again in its quality as we see businesses growing more forcibly as we come out of the various economic crises that are currently dominating our world. And just as an analogy, after the World Trade Center debacle, it for about 3 to 5 years it was impossible to sell office space above the 20th floor in New York City. It was oddly specific. I can't remember what it was, floor 20 or floor 15. It was basically that market completely disappeared. After 3 or 5 years, we're back to normal, and New York City is buzzing as it used to. And I think that is sort of where I would expect this to be. So currently, the flux into the West End, as much as it might actually happen for big companies, I would actually question whether these are the big companies anyway, as much as that is happening, I would expect it to be temporary.
Fair enough. And yeah, I mean, I think that's a very interesting way of looking at it, actually, you know, and maybe having the Elizabeth line, making it easy to travel between all three of them, you know, maybe that will make the transition more fluid, perhaps. I don't know. But I mean, you know, I've worked in the city, I've worked in the West End, I've done a lot of work, as in I've been working at companies there. I've been more of a visitor to Canary Wharf, but I used to go a lot. Yeah, I certainly feel like with the city and Canary Wharf, everyone sort of knows where they're going, and you all go in the right place. Whereas I've often heard people say that when they move, let's say, to the West End, it's noticeably different in terms of suddenly you're in with crowds of tourists and things, and it slows you down, and it's kind of, it, you know, becomes one of those first world problems of it being a bit annoying having to go round loads of tourists, or who don't know where they're going. but anyway, yeah, I mean, I personally think, for me. I would like to work in the city, but go out in the West End. That was always my preference.
Exactly. That's also what I think. I mean, obviously, this cannot be generalized. There are fund managers who are in Mayfair,
yes,
or in the West End, in fact, and that's fine. But even they tend to sort of cluster a little bit within some sort of sub-territories within the West End. You have hedge funds and family offices around Berkeley Square, perhaps. And
we used to call it Hedge Fund Alley. I forgot, I think it was around there, isn't it, basically? Because there's just loads and loads of hedge funds in the same place.
I don't know that expression, but certainly they tend to be clustered there. I mean, the reason is that the Rolls-Royce dealership is only like 10 meters away from your office.
Yeah.
Which is true.
I always used to find that they, I mean, it may be different now, but you could tell a hedge fund manager in the West End because they had one of those Patagonia gilet things underneath the suit jacket. And I mean, I think that looks pretty awful personally, but it was always Patagonia for some reason. But, you know, they used to have these under the jackets, and I'm thinking, you know, why Why do you, you know what? I don't know. Sartorially incorrect, in my opinion.
Sartorially advised, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, hey, look, I'm wearing a T-shirt, so what do I know? Anyway, so on that note, on that sartorial note, I think maybe we'll bring this to an end. But thank you, as always, Ralph, for your insights and comment and expertise, of course, today. So thank you very much indeed, and we will be back again very soon.
Absolutely, we will. Thanks for listening, guys.
Bye.